Hi, Paul.
Hi, Paul.
Excellent. Good. We've had a few technical gremlins, but we've got that sorted now. Okay, so this is about our fifth phone call, isn't it? So I'm Paul Scott, and I'm joined again by Paul Hill today, who's a very successful small cap investor and analyst. I last spoke to Paul in January. We did a very interesting audio cast covering loads of companies. So we're going to update on those companies today, talk a bit about macro, and also throw in some new stock ideas. So I'll just quickly do the disclaimers. We're not giving financial advice. This audio cast is purely for general interest and entertainment only. Please do your own research and bear in mind that Paul and myself will hold many of the shares that we talk about. Okay, right, let me throw it over to you, Paul, then, for macro factors and markets in general.
Hi, guys. Yeah, I mean, it's quite interesting, actually, because when we spoke last time, Paul, I was quite bearish on the stock, and I think since then the AIM index, or the small cap index, has gone up by 10%, and I think I'm actually now even more cautious going forward than I was, even though my own portfolio and the market has done quite well. So, and the upshot of that is that actually my portfolio is still quite highly weighted on the cash side, which is...
Yeah, because last time, I listened back to it again last night. Last time you said you were 50% in cash, weren't you, in January?
Yeah, well, I'm actually now about 55% in cash.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, I know. And what's been quite interesting, again, is that I've been struggling to find good buying opportunities. There's lots of quality stocks, but they tend to be quite highly rated.
Yeah.
And what I've been doing, which I don't like doing, I don't know what you think about it, but I end up sort of like doing trading plays, which I'm sometimes good at and sometimes less good at. And I know one of the stocks we talked about before, which was the Enquist 5.5% corporate bond.
Yeah.
This was like a quasi stock because I was trading at, when we spoke, about 51p in the pound and then shot up, and I sold out recently at about 80p. So that was great, but it's basically like a stock. That went well, but then on the oil and gas side, cause that's obviously the oil and gas play, just recently I got burnt on pressure technologies, which I think you had talked about.
I had a very lucky escape on that one, because I bought it on the way down at about £3.80, which was way, way, way too early. And then I averaged down at about, I don't know, £2.50-ish or something. And I managed to get my money back, and I sold out at about when it did that sort of blip up to about £3.20. And of course, that was just days before the next profit warning.
Yeah. And I
was very lucky on that. Did you still hold it then, that one?
No, that horrible, horrible third profit warning totally blew me out. Just for investors, Pressure Technologies works in the oil and gas sector and makes these large, big cylinders, has a lot of IPR.
Ticker, P-R-E-S.
P-R-E-S. And I knew it was going to have a challenging 2015, but the thing which really sort of put the knife into the back of my holding position on the stock was its very negative outlook for 2016, and I just thought, like you, I got in it too early, and unfortunately I sold after the event. So,
oh dear, it's bounced a bit, hasn't it?
That's right. So it comes back to that sort of, I don't know what you think about these. You know, you get sucked into occasionally into these trading plays. And if I look at the Enquist bonds and the pressure technologies on the oil and gas sector as a trading play together, I've made money on it. It's not a problem. But I don't like doing it. I don't like these trading plays because they tend to be, the hit rate is lower. But it's symptomatic of today's market. Because there aren't that many good long-term buys, you end up looking at short-term things that suck you into, you know, to trading opportunities, which I'm not a natural trader, but you're more of a trader, aren't you?
Well, I wasn't originally, but in the last year or two, I've seemed to have devoted a lot more time and energy into shorter term trading, not day trading, but maybe what you might call, I don't know, swing trading, you know, so looking for fairly significant moves over a few months or weeks rather than just day trading, and I found generally I'm not bad at it, actually. I think generally it's like everything, you know, the more effort and time you devote to it, the better you get at it, and we do seem to be in a market in the last few weeks anyway where small caps seem to want to go up.
Yes.
You know, and you seem to find that when things start moving up, then all the momentum boys jump in and start taking it higher anyway. And the trouble is, I think a lot of these moves up are happening on a completely spurious basis.
And I'd say pressure, that happened to Pressure Technology, didn't it?
And then bang, there's a profit warning.
And you smartly got out on one of those ups. And
yeah, so I think a lot of things where there is a spurious move, I think I'm tending to look at that. Right, that's time to bank some, you know, or maybe sell half or something just to protect the downside.
Yeah. But in the environment of sort of like difficult to find long-term attractive buys, do you have any sort of like investment red lines, areas and trends that you don't go? Because obviously some of your best investments are the ones you deliberately don't do. Like, I know you talk a lot about Chinese stocks. You're not a great buyer, I guess.
No, well, I think with AIM stocks, generally, I normally have a blanket rule that if it's an overseas-based operating company, you know, it might have a London sort of registered office or whatever, but if it's fundamentally an overseas company... And it's
what about US stocks?
I just won't touch them. US stock, well, I do make exceptions, but I think I have a general sort of blanket no on them.
Yeah.
But if I can be convinced that actually it's genuine, then I will occasionally break that rule. So US stocks, I do currently hold one called Somero Enterprises, the concrete screed laser guy.
Oh, yeah, talking about these guys.
Did we talk about that one last
week? I think you mentioned it. They're benefiting from the building cycle, aren't they?
Yeah, I can't see it on the list from last time. Maybe we didn't, I don't know. Possibly. Yeah, no, I tend to buy almost exclusively on news flow, on results and trading statements.
Yeah.
And that's why I write the blog. I always like to buy immediately after a positive trading update.
Yeah.
Because it usually sort of protects your downside for at least 3 to 6 months.
Yeah.
Doesn't always, though. But no, Somero, I think, is a very, very interesting company. I mean, it's you know, the question is asked, well, why would an American company list on AIM?
Yes.
So I rang the company's advisors and asked that question, and they said, well, basically, they said it listed on AIM, I think, in 2006 or 2007. And the reason was that the previous owner was a private equity outfit that wanted to, obviously, sell it for the highest price. So they sounded out in the American markets, they sounded out AIM, and at that particular point in time, AIM was attributing high valuations to that type of stock.
Right.
And it was purely and simply that the vendors wanted to maximize the price, so they floated it on AIM, and apparently the management of the company had been very happy with AIM since, and they don't see any reason to change. So
is it software? It's basically selling software into, or is it basically,
it's the laser
gadgets, is it?
It's the actual machines, yeah. They're quite big, heavy-duty machines with a sort of long boom that spreads out concrete and makes it cement.
For the foundations, is it?
For warehouse floors, really.
Okay.
Yeah, and of course, with all these this boom in internet shopping, there are all these sheds springing up, large sheds, where you often have racking, which can be many stories high within the shed.
Yes.
And of course, if the floor is even sort of half a centimetre lower at one side than a few metres away, then all this racking is going to be unstable. So having a perfectly flat concrete floor is a prerequisite now for a lot of these.
What sort of multiples do they trade on?
Very reasonable, 11 or 12, something like that.
Okay. And the balance sheet is okay?
Balance sheet's great. It's got net cash. It pays dividends. And the outlook statement was very bullish as well.
So why is it so cheap? Is it liquidity?
I think it's because it's highly, highly cyclical.
People
look back at 2008 and see that, you know, demand collapsed and they rolled into very heavy losses. But the way I look at it is that there's loads of cyclical companies on the market that are actually being put on quite high ratings at the moment. So I don't see any reason why this one should be so cheap.
The global economy is improving. It isn't actually, you know, it hasn't peaked yet in its cycle, I guess. It's still sort of going up that cycle.
Yeah, I mean, I'm quite bullish overall. I think yes, we've got all this Greek business rumbling along, but, you know, that will get fixed one way or another. And I think, you know, personally, if I had to pin the colours to the mast, I think we're probably looking at another 4 or 5 years of decent economic growth, maybe even accelerating economic growth. And I think that may be why markets generally are quite pricey, because that's probably what other people are factoring in as well.
Yeah. What about the red lines, like pension deficits? Do you like those at all? Exactly.
It's so bloody difficult, Paul, isn't it?
Yeah.
I honestly don't really know how to treat them. I mean,
I treat them, when I come to valuing this, as quasi-debt, as effectively, even though it's non-interest paying, but it's a liability on the balance sheet of future cash flows, so I treat it in that respect. And if it's a small deficit, i.e. such that, you know, in terms of the actual balance sheet, unless it's less of a problem, where it's a small deficit, but a massive scheme, either the scheme value is a significant multiple more than the company, then that gives me elevates the level of risk. The big issue you get with what I find with small caps, which is one of the reasons why I don't like pension deficits, is it tends to act, not always, as a poison pill. And one of the nice things about being a small cap investor is that you buy cheap, which is great, and you can see upside, but you then get that potential kicker of takeovers. And the amount of companies that I've bought which have been taken over when I hold for like 3, 4, 5 years.
Yeah,
that's quite a high percentage. Whereas in big caps, you don't get that, and therefore the pension deficit is less of a problem. But in small caps, that's one of the extra kickers that gives you a bit higher return.
I agree. I mean, I've always thought the same about pension deficits, but then the company that has the biggest and worst pension deficit in the small cap world, Arca, gets a bid approach. I couldn't believe I needed
to
share when I just saw that. But I suppose if the acquirer is a big enough company, and the American outfit, I forget the name of it now, but I did look at their accounts, and it's sort of 20 or 30 times the size of Arca in terms of market cap. So it's a relatively small bite. And I wonder, in that type of circumstance, if the acquirer would go to the pension trustees and say, look, it's in your interest to let us take this on, because our covenant is better than Arga's covenant, and so, you know, it's going to actually strengthen your pension fund if you agree to this deal.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anybody buys the business, they must be nuts, but, you know, I mean, the business is good, it's a great brand, but you're right, taking up a big pension deficit, You'd naturally, if you put yourself in the buyer's position, it would put you off, wouldn't it? But you're right. And I suppose if they are coming to buy it, then that does say that actually, you know, we're in a really bullish market. There's little opportunities for organic growth, and therefore acquisitions seem to be the only way of really driving the top line. And you know, people are prepared to pay almost like stupid, very optimistic prices.
Well, that's right. I mean, looking at the American markets, I mean, PEs there are so high now that I think, you know, I think with the outfit that are buying Arga are on a PE in the mid-20s.
Yes.
So, of course, them coming in and buying Arga on a PE of 11 and, you know, a pension problem that can be kicked down the road with relatively modest sort of overpayments, you know, that's a deal worth doing for them, I suppose, isn't it? So, I mean, do you see there being more M&A activity?
I think that, I mean, there's been a lot, obviously, recently. We've had, I mean, just last week there was Anite and Promethean World, and you mentioned that, say, Arga, you know, and we've had lots of others like Small Cap Bond International and Sinclair and Plus 400, which is a big one, wasn't it, just recently?
Yeah, and most of those were bid for by overseas companies as well, weren't they?
So, I mean, I actually think what's happening is that corporates, having used most of their surplus cash to buy back shares, i.e. to boost their EPS, are now looking, actually, that's gone as far as it can go, because you start bumping up against liquidity problems. And it doesn't help that we've pushed that as far as we can with regards to getting our bonuses up, and therefore they're now saying, well, okay, any surplus cash, and obviously if the corporate bond markets are giving them at such low interest rates, they can then fund it, and therefore they're going into M&A. So I actually think there's one of the tricks for you and I, and for any other small cap investor, is to look for companies of potential, you know, can be taken out. And I think still think there are a few, you know, which are, it's just, I mean, obviously, the one you talked about earlier on, you know, the Somero, it sounds like a potential acquisition opportunity on a PE of 11. And I would add to that things like, I mean, SDL is another one, which is an IT marketing / translation website company. that Danny
Ward. SDL, I don't think I know that one.
Well, it's basically a, it's sort of, I think it's a FTSE 350 stock.
Ah, oh, that'll be why.
Yeah.
Too big for me.
Yeah, well, and it's been a bit of a turnaround, or it's basically the founders come back in. The shares were originally about 3 or 4 years ago, about £7, and then they went through about 6 profit warnings and drove it down to about sort of £2.30, and that's where I got interested, and now it's at about £4, I think, something of that sort of level. And it's going, the founders come back and it's starting going through a bit of turnaround. But it competes against the likes of Microsoft and some of the other big IT companies. But clearly most of these competitors have got large offshore cash holdings, which they can't redeploy back into the US because they pay dividend tax on it, and therefore these technology stocks are looking for things to buy. So I actually think there are quite a few companies on AIM that you don't buy anything because it's an acquisition target. You buy because of the fundamentals and the upside on it. But that's one of the the extra kickers, as we talked about, for the small caps, is to try and find those companies that can give you both, really.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's often the ones you least expect where a bid comes through, though, isn't it? It's not easy to predict which companies will be bid for.
What about Indigo Vision? Would that get a bid, you reckon?
I hope so, because, I mean, I think that I've come to the conclusion on that one. This has been my continuously held biggest holding for 11 years now. I mean, I've come to the conclusion that its performance is just too lumpy. It's so dependent on individual major contract wins that, they can make up more than a whole year's profit just from one contract, which I think is untenable, a company remaining independent the size it is. I think it needs to be either a private company, which can afford to, yo-yo from losses to profits, or even run at a loss deliberately for 2 or 3 years to turbocharge growth. Or it just needs to be, taken out and bolted onto a larger corporate. So I've made my views on this clear to the company. And just said, they've tried their best. In some ways, they've done some really, really good things. So it could yet turn around, actually.
Well, the shares are cheap, aren't they?
Very cheap. I mean, if they won a couple of big major contracts, it'd be party time again, So I haven't written that one off by any means, and I think a trade would put me out of my misery, to be honest.
Another investment red line that certainly I try and avoid is the working capital cycle, and that'd be something I'd say investors should make sure they have a good look at before they buy things. Because you get a lot. I don't know if you've known it. I mean, I'm sure you have, Paul. There's a lot of AIM stocks, and they tend to be in technology, where they sell and they make good profits. The top line goes up by sort of 20%, 25%. Profits are going up by 50%, 60%. But cash is actually negative because it's all getting chucked onto the balance sheet in debtors deferred revenue and all this sort of stuff. And you look at it and you think, well, actually, they're not making any proper money here. Optically, they are. So the PE is a single digit. But in reality, they need to raise money, i.e. through placings, to actually carry on selling. And the company that really sort of touch paper with me, which was a culprit for it, a couple of years back, was Silverdale. I don't know if you remember those.
Yes. Their accounts were always a bit peculiar, weren't they?
Well, it was a classic sort of if they needed to raise money if they grew the top line organically by more than 10%. And so
that's right.
It was less than 5%, they were okay, they had enough money. Anyway, because they were going to double digit, then they blew up. But you get quite a few of them, things like Globo.
God, I hate that one. I think it's a dreadful. I mean, that one, I've got to be very careful what I say because I don't want to get sued. But, to my mind, it's dodgy as hell in my view. The account's just back up. There's so many funnies in there. And they claim to have a huge net cash pile.
Yes.
But then they took out all these enormous bank loans last year.
Yes.
Fresh bank loans. So they paid 4.1 million euros in interest.
Yes. Yeah.
On loans that they don't need because they've got more than twice that amount in cash.
And you do wonder, don't you?
well, I mean, that says to me that, you know, maybe the cash has been stolen. Why would you pay $4.1 million on interest for unnecessary bank loans? Yeah. It just doesn't stack up.
And the other sort of culprits in the area, in my view, are the telco companies, not the UK ones, which I don't mind, but tends to be more the emerging market telco ones and the mobile marketing ones. Exactly, because the debtor days tend to be about 180 to 240 days, and you look at it, you think,
Debtor days is a massive reg. Probably of all the reg types, I think debtor days is the biggest one.
Yeah.
I mean, in my experience, when you have a debtor book that's more than 6 months turnover, there's nearly always something seriously wrong, and it's going to all implode.
Yes. And the reason why it's worth mentioning is that when you look at optically at the metrics, the PE metrics for your standard AIM investor, they look at and they say they're in mobile. Good, that sounds like a growth market. They're in telco, oh, great, fantastic. And they've got blue-trick customers, great, that's brilliant. They're in emerging market, great, that's brilliant. And the PE ratio is low, and they've got a so-called solid balance sheet because they've got lots of net assets. And then therefore you don't go into detail, which is obviously where, you know, looking at the balance sheet. And then you get sucked into this whole thing whereby then the company then blows up later on down the road. Yeah.
Well, I think that's true. And then the other thing to bear in mind is that I think people rely on the auditor's opinion too much. And the reality is, dishonest management can drive a coach and horses through the accounts and hide it from the auditors very easily.
Yeah.
You know, it really is a doddle to deceive auditors. Not that I'm speaking from personal experience, but I mean, in one of the jobs I worked on when I was a trainee, a chartered accountant, I uncovered a fraud.
Yes.
And I only uncovered it because I sort of went off piste and because I could smell something was a bit funny.
Yeah.
And the audit manager, you know, was having a go at me for he used to call me Buster Budget. I would always blow the budget for terms of targeted hours by wandering off on tangents. No, it's very interesting. So any other takeover targets that you see, Paul?
It's quite interesting actually, because the ones we talked about last time, or that I mentioned, the Vislink, Tristel, and Service Power, I actually think all of those are takeover targets for different reasons.
Okay.
I mean, starting with
Should we move on to those?
Yeah,
those
probably a good idea.
So let's pull up the list here of the ones we talked about last time. Actually, Vislink was the first one. So do you want to update us on your view on Vislink?
Well, I mean, I think when we spoke last time, the shares were we're in the doghouse, I think, with investors, because the company haven't given that many updates.
Ticker's VLK on Vislink. Yeah.
And the shares were roughly around about, I think it was 35p or 34p, something of that sort of level. I mean, just for
and just for
investors' knowledge, Vislink does two things into the same sort of sector, into the broadcast sector and into the surveillance and police agency sector. And what it does software, sells into the broadcast sector to allow it to play out, and it also does very clever up and download, telecommunication hardware that smart enables the video capture and data capture of things or of events at the point of